come up with a lot of big hits here early. It seems like, though, when he's not there, you haven't really had that guy to kind of pick up for him. Is there a concern that you're not getting enough guys involved here?
Not really. I mean, we got too many good hitters in that lineup, you know. So right now, Pete is pretty much the one carrying us. But the fact that we are creating traffic and we're getting guys on base, you know, they'll step up. I like Nemo's at bat. Vientos is just not getting results, but he continued to hit the ball hard. He's not chasing. So, like I said, 1-9, we got a good offense, and they'll come through.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Monday, April the 14th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, Talking Mets No G, and don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. I come to you here early on a Monday morning. Mets just completed a weekend series in Sacramento. What are they? The Oakland A's, the Athletics Baseball Club, the La Vegas A's? I don't know who they are, but Mets complete 2 out of 3, coming to you a little bit earlier on a Monday than late on a Sunday because of the West Coast time start. Lot to get to today as we are now a couple of weeks into the season and things are starting to crystallize about the Mets. I get a sense in going into communities online and a couple of, you know, maybe a couple of emails directly to me that there's a glass half empty feel to the Mets 10-5 start. We'll get into that. Why you should maybe be concerned about something on this club. It's not what you think. We'll get into that. And of course, the week ahead, as we always do. So a lot to get into here at the Talking Mets podcast. Well, before we get into all that, little non sequitur or a side note, as I was watching the ball game this weekend, and they were showing some highlights, as SNY always does, great moments in A's history. Sometimes with the opponent, you'll get a little history lesson SNY will give you about the opponent. They sometimes repeat it because, I mean, how many times are you going to do the same thing about Atlanta and the Phillies teams you see quite a bit each year? But when I was looking at the A's, and it just struck me, what an interesting history the A's have had. Kansas City, Kansas City A's, there was the Philadelphia A's, so they've bounced around a little bit. They were known as the Yankees Farm Club in the early 60s. The Yankees used to pluck great hit players. I mean, Lou Piniella started as a member of the A's. And then, of course, there's the dynasty teams, Charlie Finley in the mid-70s, and then Charlie Finley tries to basically burn the roster down and sell everybody off, and the commissioner has to get involved and reverse a lot of that. And then, of course, you have the Bash Brothers of the 80s. We all know what happened with steroids, with Canseco, McGuire, and the great late 80s teams that Sandy Alderson helped put together. And then as the economics of baseball explode and the A's can't keep up, after, if you look in 1989 or 1990, one of those seasons, maybe 91 or 92, I can't remember, the A's had one of the top payrolls in baseball. So payroll was never an issue for Oakland. With the explosion of free agency in the 90s, that changed. So what happens? They pioneer a new way of looking at the sport and Moneyball, which has completely revolutionized the sport with Billy Beane. Billy Beane, over the last two decades, even with extreme payroll constraints, is able to put out some competitive teams over the years and teams that just could not make it past the first round or deep into the postseason, but exceeded expectations. So I don't know what's the future for the A's. I know they're going to Vegas. I know they're playing in a minor league ballpark. Mets are done with them for 2025. So we won't be thinking anything about Oakland unless somehow the Mets want to pluck someone off the roster like they did with Blackburn last year. But I just found it interesting. As you're watching the game and you hear the broadcast kind of go into great moment in today's history, Reggie Jackson, so on and so forth, it just really crystallizes how unique of a history the A's have, how unfortunate it is that they're a nomad team, and adding this crazy minor league ballpark back to the future for a lot of these guys who haven't had to walk from the dugout to the clubhouse in a minor league park like they had to this weekend. So, or, you know, do makeshift batting cages or set up things in the dugout. So goes to show you how many things that big leaguers take for granted and the amenities they have in a big league ballpark. But the Mets are 10-5. They're in first place. They got one of the best records in the National League and all of baseball. They're actually right there with the Dodgers. You know, the 96 Bulls, the team we told cannot be beaten. Some people thought they were going to go 162-0. How ridiculous is that? And, you know, not everything has gone well for this team. So as you go through a season, you have your ups, your downs, your peaks, your valleys, your thunderbolts. You know, and obviously you all know we're in this phase. We're getting to know the club that's in front of us. But here are the Mets winning 2 out of 3 on the same pace as the great 86 team. They are a below league average offensive team, which I think is the main point that's bothering everybody. They've put up some elite pitching results, better than anybody could expect it. And Kodai Senga, even though he didn't strike out a ton of batters yesterday, got big ground balls, was able to navigate in a hitter's ballpark there in Oakland. And not a bad offensive team. You got a couple of, with Soderstrom and Rooker, you've got a couple of guys on that roster that can wreck the game and break open a game and cause you a problem. So it's not a chopped liver offense. It's not a bad team. It's a plucky team. Let's put it that way. They got a couple of interesting arms too. You know, the Mets pitching has been better than ever. And not everything has gone well, though. Their closer is a mess, and we'll get to that in a little bit. You all know on offense, other than Pete Alonso, you know, now Luis Torrens, who has really stepped up in the absence of Francisco Alvarez, everybody else is kind of eh. I mean, Nimmo's been okay, but Brett Beatty's been a mess. Francisco Lindor is hitting, you know, about with a 600 OPS. Soto, other than walking, hasn't gotten on track yet. He's not really hitting the ball with any authority. Vientos doesn't seem to be able to hit any off-speed pitches, hitting a .130. Maybe yesterday's performance will get him going. On a positive note, he's actually walking quite a bit. Makes you wonder if he's changing his approach somewhat here in his sophomore season. You haven't got much from the bench. You know, Siri's going to be out. And let's not forget, both Alvarez and McNeil, two big parts of the offense, two big parts of the starting lineup, have not appeared in a regular season game yet. I think both are close, but they have not appeared in a regular season game. And by the way, on the pitching side, as good as the starting pitching has been, no Frankie Montas, no Sean Manaea. So all these things put into place, and yeah, I know out of the 15 games they faced the Marlins a couple of times and Oakland, and, you know, I mean, Toronto's in first place, but they played them in frigid temperatures at Citi Field. So, you know, maybe you say, hey, Mike, this is not the hardest part of the schedule. And it will get harder. I mean, you just look at the calendar. It'll get harder in the next couple of weeks. But these are big league clubs. These are clubs you're expected to beat. And let's face it, winning 2 out of 3 consistently will put you in a really, really good spot at the end of the year. So with all that going on, why do I get the sense that there's a glass half empty feel around this club? I what I'd like to do is get the pulse. And no, I'm not just listening to the alarmist on a WFAN like a Joe Benigno, who could go on any show and make you feel miserable about any one of his teams. You just go on X and you go into some of these Mets communities and you see some of the rhetoric, you know, going around. I see some of the emails that come to me about concerns about the offense and about the team in general. And I know that those who follow this show, that are long-term listeners of the show, a lot of you, especially the veterans of the Talking Mets podcast, you guys know who you are. You don't buy into that. And maybe I'm overreacting to a a very loud minority, maybe the toxic portion of the fan base. But in general, I mean, admit it, even someone like me or you, somebody that's more balanced about the team and a baseball season, you're probably like, yeah, there's just so much here. The way they've won, you're just like, you don't feel like this is a team that's 10-5. Now, if you go back a couple of years to 2023, if you remember during that disastrous sell-off summer, the Mets actually got off to a decent start, a similarly good start, 14-7. And, you know, I remember, I believe they were in San Francisco when things started to kind of go south. There was issues back then with the offense. In a way, the pitching was not nearly as good. The bullpen wasn't nearly as good. You had no Diaz. You were coming off of the injury in the World Baseball Classic to Diaz. So the Mets started 14-7 coming off their 101-win season in the year prior when they lost out to the Braves, but a big season under Buck. It was more business as usual. It was a team in 2022 that won consistently about 2 out of 3, and they continue to do that, but you didn't feel good about it. And a lot of that had to do with the Diaz injury, because that was basically game over before the season started. It took such the heart and soul out of this team. So is this the same? And the answer is no, because, and maybe this is a blessing and a curse, and maybe this is part of why some of you just don't feel good yet. Last year, I believe, the growth that not just this team had, but the organization had in overcoming adversity, how they performed down the stretch, how they embraced the big moment, the big situations that they were able to come through in, and the culture shift that you saw that was evident by how they, and it's finally quelled a little bit, how they stole Juan Soto across from the Yankees. And the more you read about that, the more you see how difficult that task was, more so than we could even remember or think. And you just feel like the culture has changed. So it's not the same, but you don't want to buy into that voodoo, into all that kind of stuff. Fine, that's your prerogative. Just looking at this from a baseball perspective, and I understand that the pitching is going to come back down to earth. The pitching is not going to dominate like it has the entire season. It's not. It's not. It's not possible. I mean, just coming into today, they have a 2.30 ERA. That's first in all of baseball. They are giving up about 2.73 runs per game. That's actually second in baseball, behind the Padres, who have been a squish better. But you're talking about the next teams, next batch of teams, Cincinnati, San Francisco, the White Sox in there. They're about 7/10 of a run worse. So the Mets are significantly better than league average. So as much as they're below league average on offense, and they're creeping up a little bit, they're above league average here in pitching. Now, this time of the year, stats go up and down are wild. We still have to remember, there's only 15 games into the season. And you could take any 15 to 20 game sample size throughout any part of the season, and you're going to see some anomalies. You're going to see some things that either make you smile or don't make sense. And until it becomes a trend, and that's why we break it up into thirds here, it doesn't matter much. I mean, for example, the Yankees on offense are averaging over 6 runs a game. And if you take away their 20-run outburst a couple of weeks ago against Milwaukee, it drops them a run per game. Now, they're still averaging 5.3 runs per game, which is solid, but it's a big bit of a different picture. So for the Mets, even on their offense, they've had 2 or 3 offensive outbursts, and they've been really bad. I mean, less than 3 runs a game, I think, in 7 or 8 of the 15. So they're winning a lot of 2-1, 3-1 type of ball games. And whether it's a 1-run game, no matter how that one works, or, you know, these low-scoring affairs, these are things that question the sustainability of how you can keep this up. But teams do sometimes, have strengths. And, you know, if the Mets' strength right now is their pitching and their bullpen, which outside of Diaz has been really, really good. I mean, really good. I mean, A.J. Minter has looked good. Reed Garrett continues to look good. Huascar Brazenbaum has looked really, very valuable. Max Kranich. I know Buto gave up a run on Saturday, but he's done his thing with multi-innings. Ryan Stanek, even Danny Young. And he might be the casualty when the Mets try to bring up a Manaea or a Sixth Starter, or they have to figure out what they're going to do with Daniel Nunez. I think Nunez, as the Mets bullpen continues to surge, I think Nunez is going to be kept down there as much as possible. But, you know, Young might be that casualty. And even though he was bad in Miami, he's still valuable. I mean, there's a lot of teams in this league that are going to scoop up at Danny Young and make him a somewhat important part of their bullpen. So you know that the pitching will come back down to earth, but that doesn't mean it's going to be bad. And you got to figure the offense right now, about 5% below league average, is doing that without any contributions from Lindor, Vientos, very little from Soto. They still don't have those two key components. I mean, Alonso has carried the offense the first 2 weeks here, and he started to show a little bit of coming back down to earth this week and in Oakland. You have to feel really good. So if you're feeling icky because, I don't know, you just don't think the blueprint is executed perfectly, you don't like how they haven't been able to really hit some pitching, you don't like how even a former Mets prospect, JT Ginn, has shut them down. I mean, give the opposition credit. I think the Mets have seen, and I looked, a lot of their big hitters are really hitting poorly against off-speed and breaking pitches. But if you look at, Ginn, for example, on Saturday, the slider and changeup he threw, it was, made big pitches in big spots. Those were good pitches. It wasn't like the Mets were not having a good approach. I mean, I've seen some criticism about the fact that they're too patient. I think they worked like 9 or 10 over the weekend on Friday and Saturday, each game, 3-2 counts. Vientos might be the poster child of the offense, not hitting, but working walks, not chasing. Is this a conscious effort? I've seen criticisms of, Eric Chavez and Jeremy Barnes. Is he preaching them, lifting the ball? I don't know. If you look at the Mets roster, and maybe a guy like Brett Beatty falls into this a little bit, but do you really think an Alonso or a Lindor or a Nimmo or Soto need the hitting coach? What I was told one time by somebody that's been around the game, and it was someone that I felt knew what they were talking about, that a lot of the big players, once they get established, the hitting coach is there as a tool. Whether you want to use it or not, that's up to you. They don't dictate anything. I feel like the pitching coach and pitching labs and pitchers, because of the nature of the craft, they're always more apt to come to a team. And, you've heard players say, look, I was in a certain organization and I didn't like the way they were using me. And he tried to, especially if they're struggling, they try to implement things. But even big time pitchers, Cy Young pitchers, when they go to an organization, they could get information, they could get, processes explained to them or ways that they could get better explained to them. But if they're not comfortable with it, they're going to be who they are. You sign them to be who they are on the back of their baseball card. So I'm not so sure that, other than being a tool and resource. Now, if you want to argue that that tool and resource is not giving them modern day components of hitting, I don't know. I don't know that yet. I always find it easy to blame the hitting coach for when a team is not hitting. And it's easy to blame the pitching coach when a team's not pitching. And there's components of that. But at the end of the day, it's the guys on the field, the guys who have the names on their jerseys that have to execute. And right now, the Mets haven't really got on track offensively. What do I see about this club right now? Well, I think the positive you could say is that if there was a blueprint, and I know the A's defense played a little bit into them scoring 8 runs yesterday, but yesterday was an example of how you have to play when you're playing a team that, quite simply, is a second division club. And when it's a 1-0 game late, they make it a 3-0 game and then a 4-0 game. And you're still within that scary margin of error where, hey, a bloop and a blast, it's 4-2. You go in the 9th inning with a 4-run lead. It's not a save situation. It's comfortable, but it could get wild real quick. I mean, look, and we'll get to Diaz in a minute. Look at a 3-run lead on Friday night with Diaz coming in as the closer. So when you add those tack-on runs and you make it 8-0, that's, good night, you know, do the little Steph Curry, you know, pillow over here, put him to sleep, and then you could avoid some of your A relievers. I mean, for example, yesterday they went to Minter, but they could stay away from Diaz. They could stay away from Stanek. And if you want to go about the other thing and what was big and maybe the where the turn is happening is that Kodai Senga goes to the seventh inning. I mean, no Met pitcher had seen the seventh inning. So as good as the pitching's been, and maybe you put that under, hey, they're 10-5, but you're starting to see that. So my point here is, yeah, I get it. Things have not gone exactly to the kind of blueprint that you feel is sustainable. Pitchers not going deep into games and not going a lot through the third time around the order consistently, not sustainable. Using the bullpen for 40 to 45% of your innings, not sustainable. An offense that half the time is scoring three runs or less, not sustainable to win. Having the bottom part of the lineup with guys like Beatty and Siri, and even when Hayden Singer, who hasn't done bad, significantly below league average, with three out of the nine innings of the game, you feel like that inning is an automatic 1-2-3. Not sustainable. We get it, but I don't feel, when you start to look at the not sustainable and you start to see where they're at, I feel like when these things inevitably, things work themselves out, unless you believe that Soto, Lindor, and Vientos are done. If you believe that, then no, they're not going to work themselves out. I have newsflash for you. I find that hard to believe. You know, you should feel good. I mean, at this point, the Mets... And maybe this is part of the excitement and the drama of OMG and all that happened last summer. They're now run like a boring analytical baseball team. And sometimes you see it with the Yankees across town over the years, over the last decade. When they're doing well, the analytics and the roteness and the efficiency that's created by the infrastructure that the team puts in for the analytics is applauded. But as soon as they struggle, as soon as things get boring, whether they don't score or the pitchers take him out of the game, right away, what got them there is pointed to as the problem. The Mets have been a pretty boring team since spring training started because they're efficient, because they're going out, and they brought in what they needed to bring in, and a lot of the stuff that they're working on with the pitchers is back-end pitching lab stuff, pitch design, repertoire stuff. This is inside baseball, deep in the weeds. Things that are part of success. And when you have a fun narrative like OMG Grimace and a team that was 10 games under 500 and makes this raucous comeback during the month of June and does it in a way where there's a lot of drama and walk-offs and things like that, they've had a few of that this year, it builds, I think, a level of excitement that feels good, but is anything that the Mets did in 2024 the blueprint for success? Did you want to see that again? How many teams come back from 11 under around Memorial Day when you're starting to think about selling off to not only make the postseason, but come within two games of the World Series? So I think part of what people's concerns are is that there was a lot of energy and excitement, and especially late in the year. And let's face it, the whole postseason, what happened in October with Pete's home run and beating the Phillies, and I don't know things got sour against the Dodgers, but I think that the Mets... are not that far off from beating a team like the Dodgers. I think that gets intoxicating. I think it's addictive. And then when you come back and the whole thing starts over from square one, there's a certain bit of fan letdown. And then you take into effect some of these extreme abnormalities. Blah, say that 10 times fast. And you say to yourself, well, this doesn't feel right. But it's the baseball season, and I can't make any declarations here 15 games in. I think that as things crystallize and they head to Minnesota, I think you should start to get excited about the starting pitching. I know that there's some doubts whether McGill and Griffin Canning can sustain it, especially when they can't go through three times around the order. We'll see. Remember, you do have Manaea and Montas in the wings. Manaea more near-term than Montas. I'm not sure that there's anything about the bullpen when you start to look at their FX data that's not necessarily sustainable. We'll see. You know, maybe you could quibble and say a Max Kranich is getting a lot of contact and it's his batting average on balls in play. He's a bit of lucky on that. You know, his FIP still is 1.80, even though he hasn't given up earned runs. So give me pitchers that come out of the bullpen, don't walk anybody, and have a FIP of under two. I mean, if you look, actually, the biggest problem in the bullpen, the biggest walk problem, I mean, there's a few guys like Stanek and Buddo and Reed Garrett who are skush high, but the biggest walk problem in the bullpen, the guy that's giving you the most agita is Diaz. And that's actually the concern. You told me, when I look at all the things that are going on, what is the thing that has kept me up so far with this 2025 Mets season? It's Diaz. And we'll get to that after the break. So I know that you're trained as a Mets fan to be negative. I know that not every bit of the yoke, every bit of the weight of years and years of frustration was lifted for you as a fan when the ball went over the wall in Atlanta, when Lindor hit that home run. But I think that it's a process. I think the more that this team shows success, the more they move away from a lot of the bad, especially post-2015 World Series, a lot of the bad that you've experienced. I think the more that you'll forget that, the more you'll get conditioned to feel good and positive than waiting for a harbinger of things to come. But I can tell you, I don't think the organization has any of that weight. I think the organization has turned the corner. And there's going to be periods where they don't play well. There's West Coast trips or homestands that don't go the way they want, or a series against the contender that they just didn't get the right pitching matchups. I mean, heck, even late last year when they were making their charge in August, they went to Seattle and got obliterated in Seattle, if you remember. It happens. Happened to the OMG Mets, too, after May 31st. So I think there's been a lot of reaction to the 25 Mets. I think a lot of that has to do with settling into a new season. I think the fans are not quite over or shook off the end of 2024. So there's a little bit of that hangover, and maybe the ride that you were experiencing into September into the playoffs, you're still trying to bring some of that drama and feeling back. You can't do it in April. Not that I'm a biggest fan of the Boomer and Geo show. I never was a big fan of Boomer and Carton. And Al Dukes and I have had our issues over the years. But I think Al Dukes, here I am quoting Al Dukes here on the show. I mean, this is how crazy it is. When an Al Dukes says that baseball's like the stock market, it's kind of the sport that you peek into, but you don't live and die with it every day. Well, we kind of do here at the Talking Mets podcast, but you can do that. You can watch it without living and dying it, because you got 162 games in 180 days. And if you do that and you panic after every two-game losing streak, which, by the way, the Mets haven't even had one of those yet, or you panic over every stretch of 15 games where the offense is a little up and down, then, you know, you're bringing that football NFL every given Sunday, any given Sunday. Wow, I'm messing up this morning. Any given Sunday mindset to a sport that it's just not that sport. It's just not that. So anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, second half of the show, I'll tell you what I am concerned about. And I'm not so sure it's a small sample size. I'm not so sure I know how to fix it. I know I don't know how to fix it. Do the Mets? You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this.
And the A's are down to their final strike. 1-2 coming. On the ground, Acuna in front of it. And the ball game is over. Diaz bends but does not break, and the Mets hang on. Another big night for Pete Alonso. 3 for 3, a homer, 3 RBIs, and the Mets piece it together and then hang on to defeat the A's 7-6 in their first ever game at Sutter Health Park.
What did you make of Diaz tonight?
He got the job done. That's the bottom line. On a night where he had a hard time feeling the strike zone. He was missing, especially against the left-handed hitters. I thought, you know, the experience, he was able to calm down, continue to make pitches, and got the third out, and we got the W.
All right, we're back. So I basically spent the first half of the show telling you, hey, I know that 10-5, I mean, think about it. Here we are. How far have things come? As, you know, Talking Mets podcast is concerned, as Mets fans are concerned, 15 games into last year, you had just wiped away the bad vibes of 0-5 start, and you were about 2 weeks away from a horrible May, an excruciatingly tough May that nearly derailed the season. And here the Mets are on pace for 108 wins, and I know it's early. And there's a segment, I don't know if it's a loud segment, a minority segment of the fan base that is loud or more fans than you think because they're trained to think negatively, that just feels, you know, there's a lot off with this team. Because there's a lot off with all 30 teams, because if I go and I sat with a content creator or a beat writer from any of the 30 teams, and you want to talk about the 8, 10, 12 teams that believe they're a contender for something, we'll just stick with them. They're going to give you things that they're worried about. I mean, the Dodgers, you know, lose a weekend series to the Cubs. I'm sure they have concerns. You know? So, just keep that in mind. They gave up 16 runs on Saturday night. There are reasons early, and it's never too early to say, okay, there is something here that could be a problem. And it's kind of like deja vu. I'll call it Diaz vu all over again. And that's Edwin Diaz. Now, outside of his first outing against the Astros, it's been a high wire act. It was a high wire act in back-to-back games against the Blue Jays. And it's gotten worse with his performance against Miami in the cold on the afternoon game on Wednesday. And although I was asleep and watched it on replay on MLB.tv the following morning, Friday night and how he got that save. And I know you heard Mendoza say he got the job done. You have to think, if that's the version of Diaz that you're going to see in a big spot, a good team on the road or at Citi Field, I don't care where they are, good hitters are going to find a way to get that job done. I mean, Oakland. See how hard it is to lose that? I mean, I still call the Guardians, the Indians from time to time, you know, Oakland. So the Athletics, the A's, had them on the rope. So before I get to what I see with Diaz, because I think it's pretty obvious we've talked about this and Diaz over and over and over and over again. This has been a recurring theme, and it really only went in the closet for about a year. You know, I thought about another reliever that had a career year and, you know, fell off maybe for other reasons. And it's hard to find because it's going back, 30, 35 years now. But, you know, back when they were the Indians and they were one of the best teams in baseball in the mid-90s, Cleveland had this closer named Jose Mesa. And Jose Mesa, you might remember, was an elite, dominant closer for their 95 club that took the Braves deep into the World Series and lost. I think they lost in 7 games. Saved 46 games, had an ERA of 1.13, finished second in the Cy Young, actually top 5 in MVP. And for the next couple of years, 96 and 97, Jose Mesa was one of the top closers in the sport. Now, he never was able to, even in those years, he never was able to recapture what his career year of 95 provided. And I know what you're thinking, steroids, this, I don't even want to get into that. I don't care about that. Let's just talk about the facts. And the thing about Mesa, and a lot of people point to the 97 World Series where he had a chance to close it out and he couldn't against the Marlins. And, we know what happened there. We know what happened with Renteria's big hit. And he never was the same after the 97 World Series. That was fact. He was never the same. But Mesa consistently, after that situation, I mean, he was a home run machine. He would give up home runs left and right. He was a guy that was known as kerosene on the fire. He was a guy that, as he became a setup man and he got out of Cleveland and he lost his closer job, he was a guy that you didn't mind seeing in a ball game because you figured he would find a way to, you know, walk the ballpark, give up a big hit, give up a home run. He was not a reliever out of that bullpen that you feared. He was not the reliever that you feared and was lights out in 1995. Now, Edwin Diaz is not at Jose Mesa territory yet. But we all knew that the career year he had in 2022, and he was such a fabric of the Mets. I mean, I know logically, and I saw some of the pundits like the Keith Laws of the world say, don't give him that big contract. You're paying him for past performance. It's never going to be better than this. And the Mets didn't know that he would have this goofy injury in the World Baseball Classic less than a year later. So I know from an on-paper standpoint, not signing Diaz, letting him walk, and reallocating that money would have made sense. But I don't think, I know, the Mets organization was not at the point where they could give up on a bullpen arm like that. They didn't have enough building up to him, a bridge of the bullpen, to overcome that, especially when they were expected to win. And I think he was too much the fabric because of the trumpets and the off-the-field stuff, that if you pulled him out, you just use common baseball logic, and you pulled him out of the fabric of that roster, it would have a rippling effect. And you saw exactly that when he got injured in the World Baseball Classic. I mean, that's really, you want to talk about when the 2023 Mets, and they had other issues. When the 2023 Mets lost their season, was in the World Baseball Classic, was the heart and soul of the team was ripped out. Now, I believe last year, with the struggles he had early, with how he had to get bailed out late against Atlanta, but came back and found a way to get the save, and how he was able to bend but not break in the postseason, I think a couple of things came out of that. The fallibility of Diaz, and maybe the fallibility of the version of Diaz that you see now, became more of a reality. And I think that a lot of people, myself included, said, you know, the 2022 version is probably, we're never going to see that again. But can we get a version that's better than the erratic, heartbreaking, always seem to find a way to blow a game in the worst time possible, that close ball games in 2020, 2021? Can we get that version? And you know, we all talk about 2019 and how bad he was. I mean, that's the other side. That's bad dad. That's, you know, if we got Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, yeah, that's what? That's Mr. Hyde, 2019. And I think in the course of what we saw last year, and now as you see the Mets import bullpen arms and really start to show that they may have something here with their pitching lab and the way that they develop pitchers with Hefner and whatnot, not that you want to just throw Diaz to the wolves, but the Mets are better positioned in 2025 to absorb bad Diaz stretches. God forbid you have to bench him, than ever before. I really do. I have a lot of faith that they can put Minter in the role and Stanek in the role. And I, you know, don't discount Brazenbaum and Max Kranich. Brazenbaum's already got a big save out of necessity in extra innings against Miami. You still have Nunez down in the minor leagues. I think they can navigate it. Now, Diaz has a pedigree and a resume that none of those guys have. And what Diaz was, and when he's on, the lights out, lack of contact that he produces, is exactly what you want out of the ninth inning. You cannot blow games if guys can't touch the ball. You may walk a hitter. You may even give a bloop. But if they're not going to consistently touch you, and you don't get to first base, you don't blow the game. And there's a certain amount of, like you really saw with Oakland's closer, you know, Mason Miller. When you get into that ninth inning, you do not believe that you can come back, because you just, like, if you get a hit, you're like, wow. And you know, the Mets almost did come back against them, where Torrens almost dunked one down the in the corner, tucked it in the corner in right field. But you know, once you missed that opportunity, you knew that it was gonna be really hard to get another shot there. So when you have that type of closer, and the Mets have had that with Diaz, it's a special thing. Now, we saw the same nonsense from Diaz in May of last year. Getting hit, giving up home runs, walking batters. It's nothing new. And you all know, and those who've been listening for a long time know, that I've talked about it. Diaz has complicated mechanics, and even from within, and you saw it in the postseason against, in the clincher against the Phillies. He got off to a bad start, his mechanics were off, and then he finds it. It's like all of a sudden something clicks within an inning, and then he's fine, and then he strikes the world out. So within an inning, you could see the good and the bad. He gets into these weird ruts. It's almost like a muscle cramp, and it's like you're trying to work it out. And the problem is that Diaz often, within an inning, will work it out with a one-run lead and traffic on base, which is not a comfortable situation. But let's face it, Diaz of 2024 was not the same. The velocity was down a little bit. Left-handers were able to handle him at an extremely high rate. Left-handers, actually, he was always better against left-handers than right-handers. And the long ball was always something that you worried about. He would hang a slider, or he would throw a fastball too fat. That was always part of the equation. But it became a bigger part of the equation. And look, he almost killed the Mets season multiple times last year. Not just with his bad stretch in May, what happened in Arizona in August, which he rebounded the following day. There was a lot of situations where Diaz was in the middle of the Mets, and you know, obviously we know what happened in Atlanta on that fateful afternoon game when that doubleheader. So, you know, you're probably saying to yourself, there might be some of you, I find that hard to believe. Well, Mike, you know, we've seen this happen before, and Diaz has figured it out. He's going through a bad stretch. But here's where it's a little bit different and where it's more concerning. First off, and we've saw this in spring training, the velocities have dropped to levels that, you know, honestly, I haven't even seen. I mean, he's averaging a shade over 96 miles an hour, which is a mile and a half, a mile and a half, 1.2 less than a year ago when he was down from his 98, 99 days. And we've seen a number of 94s in there. And his command and control is way off. I mean, Diaz is already, and I know for those who are subscribers to Beyond the Mic, we talked about some of this stuff, but that was before the Oakland situation on Friday. He's already given up more wild pitches this year than he did all of last year. His career high was 6 in 2016. His career high as a Met was 5 in 2021. We're not even a month into the season. He might be eclipsing that. Now, he's had bouts of where he'd hit batters like he did in 2021. He hit 9 batters. He's already hit 2 batters. He hit 3 all of last year. So he's getting a lot of this out of his system. But if you look, and particularly he's not good against either side of the plate, but now against left-handers, Diaz has been atrocious this year. I mean, he's faced 16 lefties this year. He's walked 4 of them. So he's walked a quarter of the lefties out there. They have a 938 OPS against them. He's given up a home run to a lefty. You know, he struck out 5 of those 16, which is better than the 12 righties he's faced. He's only struck out 2 of those 12. So he hasn't been good against either side, but lefties in particular, he's been bad against. And I think I don't have that in front of me. I think some of the wild pitches and the crazy, balls that Torrens couldn't block, I think they've been against left-handed batters. So you look at that, you look at the decreased velocity, you look at a guy on the mound that doesn't have that mojo, that looks to be searching and finding himself at a level that we've never seen before. Now, he's been able to navigate outside of he hasn't blown a save yet. Right? He just basically put a game away because Miami's, you know, a close game became a bit of a blowout in the cold. And he's bent but not broke against Toronto. And he bent but he didn't break against the A's. So you're like, maybe you're in the Carlos Mendoza camp and you're like, hey, he'll figure it out. But this just seems different. And I am going to be fascinated if the Mets have a 1 or 2 or even a 3-run lead against the Twins the next couple of days, and Diaz comes in, I'll be watching him closely. Now, I don't expect everything to just click and him to be perfect. But if the version of Diaz that we see now with a 94, 95, which by today's standards is an average fastball, lack of command and control, and particularly not having a good feel for his slider, that is a huge problem. And if you think that he'll just work through it, he may, but in order to get him to work through it, that might be a couple of painful ninth inning losses. And don't be surprised, the version of Diaz we see now, you're going to have a similar type of stretch like you did last May, which nearly derailed the Mets season. Now, I don't know what Mendoza's really thinking. I don't think he's going to need to use the media to send a message. Mendoza, to me, during his short tenure, has been a guy that's honest and direct and gives the media enough of what they need. It's not like he's just giving you empty corporate responses. But I also have not seen him to be somebody that communicates through the media. He's not an old school, hard-nosed coach like the Parcells, the Rileys, or like how coaches used to do back in the day, and you know, when I was growing up in the 90s, where you'd use the media routinely to send a message. It's not a methodology that is effective by today's standards with the modern athlete. It's also dangerous because of the way the media has morphed and evolved for a variety of reasons. So we don't really know what he exactly is saying to Diaz behind closed doors. And he's not going to all of a sudden panic. But, and I guess that's the question, is he truly feel like they've got everything under control and he's trying to figure it out? Because this is not something that just all of a sudden happened. We saw some of this in spring training. We saw the lower velocity in spring training. And you could talk about adrenaline and things like that. But it always seems to be this, like, Hail Mary reason for Diaz not being Diaz since pretty much the Mets reported to Port St. Lucie, and none of that seems like solutions to a very complicated problem. And make no mistake about it, yeah, can the Mets maybe navigate a Diaz bad stretch, or God forbid, I mean, this is not something I want to really figure out, a Diaz that is unusable in big spots? I don't think we're there yet, but the Mets also can't spend 2, 3, 4 weeks and blow winnable games in an environment where, hey, it's early, but you got the Mets and the Phillies in the NL East. You've got the Cubs off to a nice start. You got teams like Cincinnati and Milwaukee kind of early on figuring things out. You already got three teams in the West, San Diego, San Francisco, and LA, and let's see how San Francisco evolves playing at a high level. I mean, if things shake out, and if this is a harbinger of things to come, you're going to be having the whole NL West playing at a high level. You know the Phillies are going to be good. So you may already have only one playoff spot up for grabs. And I haven't even got into Arizona that I haven't, because Arizona's about 500. I mean, the National League is a tough league. This is the American League. And yes, you could figure things out and hover around 500 for X number of days in the season. We talk about that all the time. But if your closer blows 3, 4, 5 games in a month, and you think that that's not going to be something that comes September or late in the season, you don't look back on and say, damn, we could really have used those, then you're fooling yourself. You were talking about that last year. Jeez, the Mets might have won the division if Diaz didn't have that bad stretch last year. That's as crazy as that sounds. Still not the highest probabilistic chance, but they could have. So you want to talk about all the things that you don't feel good about, that I'm here telling you, don't worry about it. It's gonna work itself out. Diaz ain't one of those things. This is like a car that's making noises. It's getting you from point A to point B. It's navigating traffic. You'd still feel like you could go on a long distance trip and be reliable. But there's a lot of little things happening that are weird. And it's like you go into the mechanic, and the mechanic's like, don't worry about it. We'll just give it a little oil change. It'll work itself out. And you're saying to yourself, that don't feel right. And then, God forbid, you're on the highway and the thing breaks down in traffic and you're in a bad spot in the city where there's nowhere to pull over. That's kind of like how you feel about Edwin Diaz. Something bad is going to happen in a bad spot at the worst possible time, and it's going to hurt. And I hope I'm wrong. And at that point, the Mets will have decisions to make. And, you know, the bigger question, obviously, is he hurt? There's another bigger question that's even bigger than that. Is he done? Is this the beginning of the end? Because you still have a lot of contract left. I know he can opt out. He's certainly not going to opt out of this record deal if he's coming off the worst season of his career, which is where he's trending so far. But I also know, and I don't want to go and overreact, I also know I'm talking about a player here that has been in, 6 games? Pitched a little over 5 innings. Diaz has had bad 5 or 6 or even 10 inning stretches. When it's at the beginning of the year and you got an ERA close to 8, it stands out a little more. But this is a decline that we saw last year. The other question you have is, was he a product of extreme sticky stuff? Not that he wasn't able to get the job done post-Chicago in July, because he had issues before Chicago. But it was coincidental and maybe a little eyebrow-raising that as he was figuring himself out in June, he gets pinched for sticky stuff in early July in Chicago on that Sunday night. A whole nother thing, which was bizarre because he's saying he never used anything differently that he's used all along. Maybe he's gone to the other extreme. He's afraid to use anything, which is a problem, especially in cold weather, which that wasn't the factor in Sacramento this weekend. So if you want to talk about not feeling good, I mean, this is a big deal. Can the Mets overcome it? Yeah, I think that they're better positioned to overcome it. But having Diaz flame out and be unrecognizable and not usable, because right now I don't know how usable he is, even though he's gotten the job done. That wasn't on David Stern's bingo card. Now, is it a fixable part of the team? I think it is this year. But not having the Diaz, forget about 2022. Give me a better version of 21 or 20 in that small sample crazy COVID season. Give me those better versions. And, you know, they're going to blow games. There's going to be high wire acts with those versions of Diaz. I know that. But that's still a damn good closer. You know? I mean, how long before you, and I'm telling you, this will be something if Diaz struggles. And I think Clay Holmes is going to figure himself out and he's going to pitch better. And he already pitched better in his start against Miami. But how long, if the Mets are have, you know, six starters and they're all doing pretty well, will somebody write, are the Mets better with Clay Holmes coming out of the bullpen than Edwin Diaz? I mean, I'm just throwing some things that are, it's way too early for. But you could see us having this conversation in August or July, right? Clay Holmes is not going to want that conversation because Clay Holmes wants to stay as a starter, do well, and get paid. He's going to get paid more being a starter than a reliever. Let's put it that way. He knows that. So anyway, so that's all I got for you here on this early Monday morning, kicking off the week. Mets in Minnesota to wrap up their second road trip of the year. Then they come home for a nice homestand, get to see the Phillies for the first time. Continue to go to the newsletter, substack.com/@talkingmetsnoG. Great content. A lot of great feedback on the videos I've been putting up there and some of the in-week content. We'll continue to do that. We'll continue to come to you throughout the week and address topics in a different way, not just wait for Sunday. Some of the things rolling around my head for this week, maybe looking into Mark Vientos and his struggles a little bit. I wonder if Edwin Diaz will be a topic of conversation. If he has a good outing, we'll have to see how that plays out. And, you know, who knows? I mean, you know, I think we're not there yet, but with the next homestand, if Soto doesn't start to show some life, you're already seeing some of the hot takes. And don't be surprised if Soto becomes kind of like this A-Rod polarizing figure without the off-the-field nonsense in terms of baseball because of his contract, because of how he switched from one side of town to the other. So there'll be things to talk about, but the good news is these are, you know, everything I've talked about today are first place problems. You know, you always have first world problems, first place problems. You know, second division clubs. And I'll tell you what, would you rather be the Atlanta Braves right now or the Mets? And that's not a joke. You know, there's a lot of teams would sign up for 10-5 with the Mets problems right now. And we'll see where it goes. All right, that's all I got. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And don't forget the newsletter for less than a cup of coffee a month, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on Fanside and Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. Keep coming at the Substack app for the latest throughout the week. Until next week. Till then, take care, everybody. Meet the Mets. Head for the park.